Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the history of Germany with Travis Dahl and me, Judith Strusenberg. Today we'll talk about an amazing woman from the mid-12th century, a scientist, a great public speaker, and a strange example of a female rhetorician that broke all social norms and taboos. To do that means the people had to accept that and let a nun preach to them. Hildegard was a nun, then abbess. More than that, nowadays she's a saint. Because she's a bit of a German Joan d'Arc, Hildegard had visions, but also was a visionary of science and also a musical composer and writer. And well, it gets weirder.
Even Frederick I, Kaiser Barbarossa himself, was not above writing letters to Hildegard. Well, supposedly. She also corresponded with more than one pope, and folks like Bernard of Clairvaux, now also a saint. And, I mean, imagine a crowd of people in 12th century Europe, like a church congregation. Who's at the front of the church? A guy with a big hat, right? I find it hard to picture a nun excitedly holding the attention of a crowd at that time. In fact, that wasn't normal at all, if not forbidden. So how could Hildegard of Bingen cross over these social norms and preach to crowd after crowd in her life? And there's a couple parallels to Joan of Arc, like Judith said, and not many, actually. There's a couple other saints that people kind of lump together, or like the female doctors of the church. But I'm just completely fascinated by this character, so let's dive right in.
Yeah, one can say Bingen is in Rheinland-Pfalz. We are at a time of the Crusades and the boom of the abbeys and monasteries. Hildegard is also known as the German prophetess, as the Sibyl of the Rhine, a noble woman who gets sent off to a monastery at the age of 16. She was the youngest of a lot of sisters and brothers, 7 or 10, one do not exactly know. Or Travis? Not
so
pretty sure.
So says 10, but we only have records for 7. I don't know. Why did I write down? Yeah, I was watching some documentary where it's like the youngest of 10. So maybe there was a couple of stillbirths or something. I really don't know. But we only have like records of 7. She was the youngest of 7 for sure, at least 7.
She was born in Mainz, just north of Worms and Speyer on the Rhine. By her, you know, from the heirloom episode about the Speyer Cathedral. She is one of the most well-known prophetess of the Middle Ages. She was of a noble family, but there was something quite special about her. What happened to her as she was a child, Travis?
Already from a very young age, like as early as she can remember, basically, at least she had her first vision at 3, which was in 1101. She was born in 1098. And at the age of 5, she kind of already understood that she was seeing visions. And the first things was kind of like, like there would be a bright light in the woods, like a light coming from heaven. And she had all these revelations of like, all people are sparks of God's light and all these... like she felt like the light going through her like a warming flame and like the sunshine itself. And I don't know, if we had a psychoanalyst here, I don't know. Like, I wish I knew more about this. But because also when she went to the monastery, so Tsetayev says 16. Also some, I don't know why Tsetayev says that, because I read 8 or some sources say 14. So I don't know. But in any case, she went to the monastery. I mean, it could have also been she went to the monastery at age 8 and she became a nun at age 14. That's also, that could be maybe, I don't know. But she came under the care of a nun named Yuta, who was a specific kind of nun who was like secluded and lived kind of, secluded, like lived by herself and didn't have a lot of contact with other people. But Yuta was also a visionary. So I really wonder, I don't want to be like a skeptic or super suspicious about all these things. But I am, like, I'm always curious of like what really happened. But in any case, like, she did also have so some visions were just straight kind of like about like Christian stuff, like maybe we'll come back to this, but also like to give her some insight of like Psalms or Old and New, kind of the Bible, Old and New Testament. And eventually, not until she was like 40 or so, she wrote these down on a wax tablet. We'll get back to this. And her first work describes 26 visions, including the end of times, like the apocalypse and all of that. And at first, she only told Yuta, her nun caretaker and mentor, and she didn't write them down until she was 42. God kind of made her, like, she became sick. God told her to write this down. Write down what she sees and hears, and she was kind of afraid of, I guess this takes a lot of courage, I don't know. And then she became ill, and so until finally, but she also like asked for permission from the Pope, and the Pope said yes, you know, write down your visions and everything. So she got official blessing from the church. But already at this time she was a preacher, so this is really probably what I find the most interesting is. It's a very hard thing for me to imagine a woman nun really captivating 100 or hundreds of people in the Middle Ages, because this was like almost taboo. So people really, in her lifetime, they came to her as someone that's like maybe holy, maybe a living saint, maybe a, you know, and in that regard is kind of like the way the French saw Joan of Arc. So
she was very asked because mm-hmm. She had a lot of knowledge about medicine and about herbs and about this kind of stuff. I did a quick research, and it is, as you said, she was brought to the monastery at the age of 8, and she became a nun at the age of 14.
There you go.
And Yuta was brought, started her life in the monastery at the same time when Hildegard went there, and she was 8 years older than her.
Oh, not even that. Yeah. Okay. Not even that much older. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting then, because eventually Yuta dies and Hildegard's still pretty young and she takes over. Okay. That's all right. Yeah. I thought Yuta was like an older mentor maybe, because she dies when, I don't know, maybe she's still 30. Hildegard's still 30. That's not so not so old. But yeah,
we're in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, Hildegard lived until in her 70s. Yeah. So kind of interesting.
Yeah, she became old, but there were lots of possibilities to die.
It seems like you stub your finger, you get infected, you die. So some of her visions, I wrote down one thing from Wikipedia, which was, I'll just read that. It was kind of, so Wikipedia says some of her visions. So she wrote one thing about medicine. I wrote down some notes there. I'll get back to that. But then she also wrote she saw some visions explaining the Bible or something, like the creation and fall of Adam and Eve. And she wrote this down, the structure of the universe, described as the shape of an egg, which you see a lot in alchemy, actually, and then kind of the relationship between body and soul, God's relationship to his people through the synagogue and the choirs of angels. And then the second part of that work, which is 7 different visions, describe the order of redemption, like the coming of Christ, the Trinity, the church as the bride of Christ. So like all these it's just like these symbols kind of about the church, the orders of the church, Christ's sacrifice on the cross, like all these, the stages of just a lot of Christian stuff, I suppose. There's also, even in the same works, she writes about music a lot and all that. Now, late in life, she wrote or commissioned a very beautiful manuscript known as the Rupertsburg Codex. And this is a really interesting book. Like, I nerd out on actual books. Like, I love this story. The Rupertsburg Codex might still be out there somewhere, like we hope. But it's been lost since the evacuation of Dresden in 1945. So, like, if you have a really big book laying around and it looks, like, really old, maybe, like, 900 years old, on rich parchment, finely illuminated parchment with really rich colors, give it back. Thanks. It's lost. Yeah, it's like it's crazy. It might still be out there. Maybe it was burned in Dresden fires, or maybe who knows? It's just a lost thing. It's just really sad. But there was a copy of it made in the 1920s, so we do know what it looks like and everything.
And this copy still exists.
Yep, that you can go see somewhere. Maybe even in Dresden. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Oh, quite interesting. There's another interesting link from this Hildegard episode to an episode we've done earlier, because when Hildegard became a nun and made this officially, there's a bishop and she had to speak a vow that she will be a nun. And this bishop was Otto of Bamberg, and he was just there because the other bishop, which should have taken the professor from Hildegard, was in prison. And this was Adalbert of Mainz. That guy, yes. And still, we're back at one of the Henrys. I think it's Henry the Fourth.
Yeah, it must be one of the later, Henry IV or Fifth. Yeah,
brought Adalbert to prison.
Yeah, there you go. Yep. So, definitely in this time period. So, I've talked about this time period in science, even in History of Alchemy. But this is kind of more of like that kind of episode than the History of Germany episode, which is great. Like, this is because she's really interesting. She also, I guess what's known, if you go through her life, the main thing is she was in this monastery, and then she eventually did found her own monastery and kind of break off from where she grew up, I guess. And that was really interesting. So Abbot Kuno, who was the head of the old monastery, said no to the move, and so she went over his head to Archbishop of Mainz. Even then, Kuno refused, and so she became paralyzed. This happened a couple times, actually. Hildegard became sick, and so then she was able to do something, which is, like, write down her visions, or in this case, move. So I don't want to be a skeptic, but it's kind of suspicious, I think. Anyways, so Rupertsburg Monastery is what she founds in, like, 1150. And the monks don't want her to leave. They actually blackmail her. They threaten to, like, say horrible things about her or to, whatever. I don't even know what they said. But eventually she does. And it's she founds Rupertsberg right on the Rhine and some other river kind of where they meet. And it's in this time where she really, like, hits the road. She goes on tour. She preaches. She has many, many fans. Like, people come to her because, like you said, she's a healer, but also because just people want to hear her wisdom, her prophecies and everything. And now there's a legend where she meets Barbarossa, and we do have letters from Barbarossa, but many historians suspect them to be fake. So it's kind of, I don't know, it's questionable. I didn't look at it that much, but there is Wiesbadener Giant Codex, Riesen Codex. There's some letter from Barbarossa to Hildegard. So that's kind of like, we'll get to Kaiser Barbarossa soon. You know, she might have actually counseled him in the when he was at the Ingelheimer Kaiserpfalz, like the imperial palace. So that's, yeah, so that's just kind of like, I don't know if that really happened. I don't know if all historians agree with that, but she definitely, like, that's the caliber. She wrote to very, like, two popes. You know, popes gave her permission in her lifetime. She was seen as this visionary prophetess, kind of. But there was an investigation. So Eugene, Pope Eugene III, comes to Germany to actually kind of judge her, like decide if she's real or not. So there's an investigation, like, is she being possessed by the devil or something? No, the church said, no, she's inspired by God. Like, she's getting knowledge from God. So now that's in her autobiography. She wrote some Vita. There's no other sources that say this. So I don't know. There's a lot of things about her that are not certain. Like, there's nothing in the Vatican that backs this up, I think. But yeah, she did write to more than one pope. So yeah, in any case, where she lived, Rupert's Berg, later, after her death, eventually that area is called Bingen. So in her time, she was not Hildegard of Bingen. She was born in Mainz, or someplace, whatever. But yeah, later that's Bingen, and so it's kind of she's Hildegard of Bingen.
Did you know that she haven't wrote all her books and stuff by herself, that she had a writer for that?
I heard there was some monk. Yeah, she dictated stuff to a monk or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I read saying, like, yeah, she got sick and then she asked the Pope for permission, and then the Pope gave her permission, and then she told the stories to a monk who wrote it down. The simple version is, like, she started writing down her stuff when she was 40. But yeah, something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it her is pretty Latin. Interesting. So
yeah.
I want to talk about, okay, let's take a step back. So I want to talk about her visions, but also, let's go into her medicine a little bit. I don't know that much. I wrote down some notes that I kind of figured out. But she was, so that she had a special room, an extra gate in the monastery wall just for her, because kind of like she was a VIP. The people from the towns would come to her. They, like, maybe she was like a miracle healer, they believed. So, you know, they definitely thought that, you know, like I said, like, she was a saint. She could, you know, the folks, she did kind of this cult status even in her time. She also, like, she was the first person to actually describe, the first person that we know of to ever describe, like, the female orgasm. And of course, now, wait a minute. Hey, wait, she's a nun, right? So wait a minute. So it's assumed that this was, like, told to her by townswomen or something. But Hildegard, like, she's connected with love. She has, like, she's very different tone when one thinks of Hildegard than the cold Middle Ages, like, this oppressive kind of brutal time. Like, but there was critics against her. There was an inspection. There was the Bishop of Verdun on assignment from the Pope. But one thing I want to mention that's weird is she also had her own, she invented her own weird language, which is called Lingua Ignota. She also did great works in, like, categorization. So we talked about her religious visionary theology, but she was also really interesting in musical compositions. So a lot of those are, and plays. There's a play called Ordo Vituum, which kind of is about, it's a musical about, and morality play, kind of. Now, she also, yeah, many of her sermons were written down in the, like, right after her death, or right in her later life in the 1160s and 70s. But this Lingua Ignota, unknown language, so it has its own, this is crazy. This is, like, it has its own alphabet. It's a little bit like,
yes.
We have examples of this in, like, Ignokian and other alphabets kind of later. But this is, she used it for some mystical purposes, maybe as part of her visions. Maybe that's the language she received her visions in. I have a sample here from Wikipedia. It's like, O Orchis Ecclesia. That sounds like Latin, actually. Armis divinis praesincta. That sounds really like Latin.
It's a mixture of German, Latin, Old Greek, Hebraic, and Pseudo-Hebraic.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Really interesting.
Yeah. So considering this is from the 12th century, it's just like, super fascinating. So on the one hand, she has a reputation of like this religious character. She also preached and did morality. And like music. But it's still, even her music and her plays were often religious. But then there's also her as she's a doctor of the church. She was really into medicine. And in some regard, she's a very important source because not many women of her time could write Latin. Now, today, the University of Würzburg, they're actually exploring her cures again. So this is kind of in the branch of like Klostermedizin, like monastery medicine. And we know, especially in the 10th, 11th, 12th century, this is like on History of Alchemy, we've talked of other doctors of the church from this time, like Albertus Magnus or Thomas Aquinas. So here's a female one. And it's a lot of folk medicine. It's believed that she gathered this knowledge. She maybe wasn't so much of a doctor herself, but people did come for advice. And so, it's not all empirical. Not all of it really would work. So it's kind of, but it is this, her writing it down is now kind of known as Hildegardine medicine, like Hildegardian medicine. So, and it doesn't always make sense without medieval thinking, like the four humors and the four elements and blah, blah, blah. Even if this was like psychosomatic, like a placebo effect, it helped. People came to her, people got cured. I don't want to, the term Hildegard medicine is a German marketing term since like 1970, really kind of as a, I think Judith, before the show, we were just chatting and Judith's like, I know of this movement it kind of goes along with like folk medicine and homeopathy and all kinds of other weird
new
theories.
New
age, exactly. New age medicine. But it's neat. So even her, like, oh man, I gotta be so careful here. I will nerd out on history of, so Al-Razis. I'm a big fan of like Al-Razis because some medieval thinker, because he was known in Hildegard's time, by the way, but he also categorized, in Europe, like Thomas Aquinas and stuff knew him, and he categorized things, minerals, plants, stuff, and so did Hildegard. So, like, various plants, stones, fish, reptiles, animals, she would, like, group them by their traits, which is, like, folks, that's science. That's what biologists do. They look at DNA and they're like, oh, this is in this genus, this species, this. She did that 1,000 years ago, and I think that's fascinating stuff. She also looked at the human body. Now, in medieval thinking, so first of all, so some of it is like when you bleed someone, like you use the leeches and the bleeding, she wrote about that. She gave instructions on that, like you only bleed when the moon is waning. You only, like there's certain veins, like where those veins are to bleed. So there was a weird pseudoscience between bleeding, which I don't know how much people know about. But yeah, it was like, so how much do you bleed? The amount that a thirsty person can swallow in one gulp. Okay, that's very scientific. That's 10 centiliters. But even the bleeding of animals. So you need to bleed your dog or cat, like no worries. She's got your, but she also had like how to treat burns, cuts, even like dislocation, like if you dislocate your arm or, fracture your bones and fracture an arm or something. There's a lot of, and then of course, in all kinds of medicine that men don't write about, like maybe the female orgasm or, the menstrual cycle or something. Hildegard did write about that, like she wrote about everything else. So when history of medicine historians study the Middle Ages, they all know about Hildegard, like definitely. In my world, she's not so famous, but yeah, if you study history of medicine, like she's great. And it's like she wrote about, like when she wrote about the human body, you can go into like this hermetic belief of like the microcosm, macrocosm, like when, like, astrology, how far down this rabbit hole do we want to go? Like, why does, like, everything above in the stars, it was believed that also affects your body. So you should do certain things when Mercury is in Sagittarius, okay? Because when Mercury is in Sagittarius, then that means your body is going through this time and maybe you should be bled or maybe you should eat more soup or whatever, okay? There's a, I don't know, it was this whole pseudoscience in the Middle Ages. So she wrote about that. If you're curious about that, I have a whole podcast on that called The History of Alchemy, which is like 80 episodes of microcosm, macrocosm, hermeticism, as above, so below, mystical stuff. So why don't you go there? Now here, another theory she had was, and this I find very German, but gardening makes one healthy because it's called viriditas, like this greening power, which I think is very German. It's like you go outside, you do your yard work, and somehow this is like so in Germany there's a sort of there's a whole philosophy around this that we don't know about, called like a Kur, where you go on vacation to a spa town, but it's actually covered by insurance, and you go do relaxing things like be in a spa or whatever. But there is actually a Hildegard type Kur, which I didn't look at that much, and this is so German, I don't know how to translate this, but you go do Hildegardian things. Like, so insurance will pay for you to go off work because you're too stressed. You go take a Hildegard Kur, and you go plant some tomatoes and do this or that thing, and it's all covered by...
I have never heard about this Hildegard Kur, and I even haven't heard that the insurance would pay for it. In fact, there are cures in Germany which are paid by the insurance. Mm-hmm. If you got sick and got a broken bones, for example, which you need a long time to heal, or you had cancer or stuff like this.
The government will pay for your spa town. We don't. That nothing like that exists in America.
And it's not exactly no. It's not kind of spa. It's medical useful things which help you.
Like physiotherapy or rehab kind of stuff, which insurance would cover, but Kur also means spa town in a very relaxing sense, which German insurance also covers. And you can take sick days off of work for that. And so it's not a one-to-one translation. But then there's also like, there's like medical. So we just don't have that whole idea or concept.
Okay.
I just Googled this Hildegard Kur, which is, so you go to this hotel and then you basically get, so you get a Hildegard and spices. Oh, healing herbs and spices. And boy, this is weird. So, and that's how the Hildegard spirit or Hildegard ghost, Hildegard spirit probably, pulls a green thread through your whole house. Now, this is some pretty new age stuff here.
Yes.
And I'm trying to be respectful. I don't think any doctors actually, this is folk medicine. Okay. There's Hildegard medicine, which is really new age, kind of a holistic sort of thing, I believe, looks like. And then there's Hildegard kitchen, which is, it is a kind of special diet, looks like focusing on digestion. Völlegefühl. Yeah. For a gutes Bauchgefühl, for a good stomach feeling, pretty new age stuff. So, and then I see at the bottom there's other like bio hotel. So it's kind of hippy dippy stuff, but it's come back. So in the German speaking world, you might hear of Hildegardian theories, medicine, cooking, and that kind of thing.
Be careful. People just want to sell you stuff.
Now, I'm curious about the University of Würzburg is studying it, so I wonder what their conclusions are, because I'm sure there's some herbs that, of course, do have medicinal use.
Yes, of course.
So that I would be curious about, this hildegardkur.de hotel. Maybe skip that. But yeah, I wonder. You know, that is kind of interesting. Now, okay. The other thing that she wrote about that I thought was really interesting, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this, is that so far we paint a pretty good picture of her. If especially if you're Catholic, then you know she's a saint now. So she had a pretty interesting life, but she also was very clear about who should be nuns and not, because in the Middle Ages, only nobility became monks and nuns. The common people were not thought to be, they couldn't be intelligent enough to be pious enough to serve God the way that monks and nuns could. And so, and people asked her, like, you know, what about, you know, social mobility? Is there some way for people to, you know, just people asked her, like, can peasants become nuns? And she was like, nope. Woman may be made from man, but no man can be made without a woman. So she was like a feminist on the one side, fighting for women's rights, I guess, maybe you could kind of say. But when it came to nobility, no. She was like very clear that no. Everybody was born in their place that where God wants them, and no one could fight God's will in that regard. So if you're a peasant, you're always going to be a peasant. And by the way, you can never be a monk or a nun, which to our modern ears is maybe a little bit strange. I think many things actually of Hildegard of Bingen are a little bit strange to our modern ears, but I was surprised. Like,
it's absolutely clear that a lot of nobility became a monk or nuns because wasn't just one son who could be king or earl or whatever. Yeah. And you had to look what to do with the rest of the kids. And so, put them in a monastery where they serve God, pray for the family, and gain some high positions in church. Yeah, why not?
Many monks gave up their wealth. And so maybe even to come into a monastery, it might actually, in a way, it cost money. And say, yes, you can be a Benedictine monk, but we need, you know, but we need all your wealth. Oh, you don't have any wealth? Then go away. Like, it's just weird. It's kind of interesting.
For example, the Rupertsberg monastery, the land where it was built on, it had to come from somewhere, and it belonged to Hildegard's family before there was the monastery built on, for example.
Yeah, what was I reading? Also, like Jutta. Well, did you say that maybe? Jutta was the sister of some nobleman. It's true if you think
about
it.
No, I did not say, she was a noble woman as well.
So, I don't even know when that changed exactly. I guess I could Google that. But I thought that was interesting. Like, not only is that the case, but it was like... Yeah, she was a strong believer in that's the way it should be. Noble women are by birth, have some birthright. And I was like, huh, that's an interesting take on society from someone who seems to be, you know, a feminist and this kind of thing. But again, from, you know, we're looking at this with modern eyes and ears. So,
yeah. And in medieval society, you had... were able to do two things with a noble daughter. You could have had married her to some rich and important guy, or put her to a monastery.
Yeah, and remember, the youngest of like 10?
Yeah.
It kind of all makes sense, but yeah, weird. Her visions... Do you have an opinion? What do you think? I don't know how much you looked at, like, I'm always curious, like, was she crazy? Was she lying? Did she have visions because she was mentally ill? Or, you know, are you Catholic? Do you think she really, like, God told her something? I don't know. Do you have an opinion?
I'm not Catholic, and I don't know. I really don't know. It's all possible. I think she believed in what she saw, that the visions, I think it was a strong thing in her life, a very important thing, which made her the woman she was. But where the visions came from,
mm-hmm.
is nobody can and will be able to answer you.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Yeah. Joan of Arc, of course, people have been wondering that forever and ever and debating and, oh, maybe she ate some tainted rye bread and was tripping on mushrooms or something, you know, like, I don't know. The thing is that it's dangerous. If you're lying and you say, oh, God is speaking to me, Joan of Arc did die burnt on the stake as a heretic by the British. So, like, I think... it really is. It's kind of, it's risky, and it's known that it's risky. If you're lying to get attention in this way, and people do, there's charlatans throughout history of people saying they see visions from God, but in this day and age, it was really, and she was investigated. Even the Pope had an investigation done on her, but I don't know. Yeah, I mean, if it was tainted water, if it was bad water or bad food, then why don't other people have it? It must have been a mental illness if it was. But on, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm a natural skeptic. I think everybody's a liar. And like she didn't write any of this down until she was 40. So she says that she did it. She saw them since she was 3 years old. But I don't, you know, you can lie when you're 40 and say that. I don't know. So Yuta might know more. Yuta would have really believed her or not believed her. Yuta also supposedly had visions, so maybe she told her how to lie better. And I don't know. Maybe she had visions, quote unquote. It's like she lied about it to be able to open her own monastery and be able to be free from the other abbot. I don't think we have enough information. And obviously, if you're religious, then hey, maybe God told her stuff. I don't know enough about her vision, because if you're a prophet, then maybe you saw the future, and then if stuff happened the way you saw it, then like, oh, that's pretty miraculous. But I don't even know enough about that. So the end of times, that hasn't happened yet, so we'll have to wait and see if she's right, I guess. In any case, on the 17th of September, 1179... Hildegard passed away. She was 81. She was 77. Oh, whatever. She was in her late 70s, early 80s. And her sisters claimed they saw two streams of light appear in the skies and cross over the room where she was dying. So there was already a miraculous thing there. And she wasn't made a saint until 2012. So that's kind of interesting. Now, to this day, this is so cool. Like, there's still a shrine. Her relic stuff is carried around the vineyards around Rüdeberg on the Rhine once a year by the nuns there. So I think her monastery doesn't exist anymore, but there's a monastery in the area that inherited the relics. I forget. I looked up the story, but I forgot. And she's a doctor of the church, which only 35 saints are doctors of the church, and there's only 4 women doctors of the church. And that made me very curious. So I will tell you, I looked it up. So there's Hildegard. There's also, there's one in, I'm going to guess, France, because her name is Thérèse of Lisieux. She also had, yeah, so she's a 19th century, so she's like very modern saint, by the way. And she had visions, I believe, but she was already, wait, is that true? Because the others did have visions. This one, she's very late, like 19th century. I don't care about her. The other two are more related. So St. Catherine of Siena had visions. She's from 14th century in Siena in Tuscany, like, you know, northern Italy. And then St. Teresa of Avila in Spain also had like kind of like great mystic and visions and stuff. And these were all nuns. 2 of the 3 were nuns. And 1515 to 1582. So Hildegard is the oldest, first of all. But when I did some digging, it turns out that there was no female doctor of the church until 1970. So it is a pretty modern Catholic thing to do, to name female women doctors of the church. I'm interested in that stuff. Maybe no one else cares, but yeah. And in fact, it was St. Teresa of Avila that was the first one named in 1970. Is that right? Yeah, yeah. So she was the first female doctor of the church. So it seems like, I don't know, it's kind of modern history to find more female saints and name them doctor of the church. But Hildegard, none of these other women actually were as much, like, wrote, like, medicine stuff down in Latin. And definitely nobody as early as Hildegard. So I think that's fascinating. Yeah, I really like the whole story of even that, like her getting recognition in the church, because for centuries, you will see people say Saint Hildegard, but she was like a folks saint. She was not officially recognized until Benedict. It was Ratzinger that called her a saint in 2012. So very modern history. That's 6 years ago as of this recording. People have been interested in her medicine. People have been interested in her visions and stuff starting in like 1900s and kind of looking at it again. Same with like Joan of Arc and those other people where people are just curious of what really happened. Now, her monastery, there's an abbey, St. Hildegard Abbey, but it wasn't founded until 1904. And it's right, it's the one that kind of, it's the heir of her abbey. Well, there's the usual, like, there's a planet named after her, 898 Hildegard. You know, Kepler has his planet, Hilde has hers. I watched a documentary, which is just called Hildegard, or Hildegard of Bingen. It's from the 90s, 1994 or so. It was weird. It was dramatized, so kind of easy to watch. It was, if you don't know anything about Hildegard, it starts off when she's like 40 years old. So it's already, I don't know, it didn't help me much for this episode, but it was a neat story. And ZDF has Die Deutschen, one of the episodes, is about Hildegard. And she appears in Barbarossa 2009, which is, who does that? Angela Molina and Barbarossa. Okay, but the character appears in a movie called Barbarossa. Now, I guess even in Germany, you probably don't really learn about her in school. You probably hear who she is here and there, maybe about Hildegard medicine, and she's a known character.
Yes.
But in English, I just thought less. Especially if you're not Catholic, you probably never heard of Saint Hildegard. So, yeah. Anybody who invents their own alphabet is going to get welcomed to Podcast Nick, I feel. Like, for sure.
Yes, everybody who can help us to encrypt the Voynich manuscript. Yeah.
Oh my god, I'm reading another chapter on that, and it's so cool.
It's amazing, or?
So cool. Yeah, we did one episode on it, but I'm going to mention it again in my book I'm writing, because I have yet new information about maybe how Rudolf II got it. Like, oh my god, I love that. I could read about that all day, yeah.
Yes, it's a totally fascinating story. I pretty much love it.
I hope it was somebody just doing a joke. Like, I hope it was somebody just like, ha, 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 I'm going to mess up people in 500 years with, because it makes no sense. But yeah, that's a whole other. by the way, the Voynich manuscript is about this time. So it maybe was written in this time. It was, for a while, they thought it was like Thomas Aquinas is like, 50 years after. Ooh, Thomas Aquinas. Anyways, yeah, he wasn't even in Germany, so who cares? Or German. But yeah, like, it's that time. So her herbal manuscripts, it's that style. It's that time. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, maybe her herbs had inspired someone to paint strange pictures and write stuff in a language ever understand.
Yeah, I wonder if it's some of the same characters.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Travis J. Dow will encrypt live on the show the Voynich manuscript.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going to happen right now.
And afterwards, we go for the Bernstein Zimmer. How is it called in English?
The Amber
Bernstein
Room.
Yeah. The Amber Room. Yeah.
Let's find it. It's in St. Petersburg. Come on. How is that even a mystery? Let's go. I'll show you where it is. Really? People haven't found it yet? I'll show you. No problem. I know where it is. Yeah, it's totally different. Okay, so my theory is wrong, but...
Oh, damn it.
Oh, that is cool to see them side by side, though. Not that different. G is H, H is... I think they just mixed some things up. Oh, hey, guys. Okay, so listen, the Voynich manuscript is really easy. It just says, listen to History of... What? Germany podcast.
Germany.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool. It says what? It go to podcastnikshop.com. Huh. Crazy. Well, there's mystery solved, everybody. Have a nice day. No, that's the wrong podcast.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.